Wicked Cool Feature Alert.
Hey there, podcast fans. Thanks for listening. Now, you can also reach out and send me a text message. On every episode, at the top of the show notes, you'll see a link that says, Send Us a Text Message. Simply click it, write something super nice and sweet, and away we go. Also remember to please subscribe, share this podcast with a friend by telling them about it, and leave us a positive review, whether it's on Apple, Spotify, your favorite podcast streaming service, or even on our website at www.afraidofnothingpodcast.com. Welcome to our 100th episode. What a momentous occasion this is. It's so big, I didn't want to have one guest. I wanted to have many guests. But since this is a low-budget deal, I did a retrospective, a mashup of the top 50 episodes, and I pulled out some of my favorite clips. And then in a follow-up to this, I'm going to take the best of the rest from episode 51 to 99. So this is going to be a two-part celebration. So stick around, enjoy, and hey, up front, thank you for coming along for the ride. Really appreciate all my guests and all my listeners. Means a lot. Thank you so much.
In a world where nothing is known, nothing is certain, reality is not real. Wake up! Be afraid of nothing. I'm Bob Heskey.
Robert.
The host with the ghost.
This is my podcast, based on my paranormal documentary, Afraid of Nothing. Each episode, we talk to people who see life and the afterlife through a different lens. Join me.
Who is this large man? And what's he doing in our bedroom?
As we lift the veil and open our minds to see beyond our eyes lie. This is Afraid of Nothing. Nothing.
We start with a clip from the beginning. We start with a clip from the beginning. Oh my, we start with our first show. How about that? Our first episode is called Afraid of Demons and Dark Entities with Brad Little Frog Hudson.
When I met Emily, that was crazy for me because I had an experience that very few of my shamanic friends have replicated. And that was doing a journey for Emily. I believe she had a little touch of pneumonia or a spot in her lung.
Yeah.
I remember correctly.
Yep.
So I did a journey to her spirit body to work on her. And she showed up in my journey. And it was the wildest thing. I mean, she was there standing right next to me while I was working on her. And she was very interested in everything. And then when it came time to leave, I asked her if she needed help getting home. And she said, oh, no, I know where I'm going. And said goodbye and disappeared.
Yeah, that was crazy when we got that email from you. And you kind of explained that. I was like, of all the hundreds to thousands of journeys that you've done, I mean, look, there's this process, right? You want to just walk us very quickly through the process where you go to the rock or the cave and then you go to the tree and whatever. And there's at some point in that journey, she was waiting for you, right?
Yeah, yeah. I usually go, I have 50 acres of Audubon land in my backyard. I'm very fortunate. And I usually walk out. In my mind, I'm walking out into the woods to a very specific tree, and I press a button on the tree, and it's like an elevator door opens up, and I step in, and I go down to the lower world, the shamanic lower world. And Emily was standing waiting for me at the tree. You could have knocked me over with a feather. It was an incredibly amazing, beautiful experience, and it really verified a lot of the stuff that I knew about autistic kids. And now I have an autistic grandson who's 2 years old.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's extremely interesting in working with him. And, you know, we get to watch him one day or 1.5 days a week. So I continue to have work with the autistic kids.
Episode 4 was with Colleen Costello, the Celtic medium. This was the second of a two-part interview with Colleen. It was called Afraid of When Ghosts Attack.
The USS Salem, that was the big doozy. That was the one that scared the hell out of me. I actually was doing a tour, so I was bringing a group of people in, and we did the whole tour. So I brought a whole group of people in to the mess hall. I was assigned to the mess hall, and I did the whole night at the mess hall, and we did our investigating there. And so I had led this group of people, and we were in the mess hall. Again, as we had discussed earlier on, because the USS Salem was mainly men, you know, obviously sailors, the energy for women there was kind of negative. There was a couple of, you know, vibes there that were kind of like, you shouldn't be here. It's just more of a men's area. So there was an earthquake. There was a big earthquake in Greece. And the USS Salem went as a rescue ship, and they rescued hundreds of women and children and men off the island of Greece, off one of these islands in Greece, brought them aboard the ship, and the ship turned into a big rescue vessel. They brought aboard lots of these people. A lot of them died on the ship. And I don't know how long they actually spent on the ship, but I think that was the first time they actually had women and children on board. So there's a lot of spirits left on the ship from that particular time. When I was in the mess hall, I connected with a woman. And this particular woman was desperate and she was frantic. So she kept frantically looking for her child, her son. And she was going around and round and round and round frantically looking for her son. So I was trying to find her son for her. And what I had realized was I can't actually remember because I was so traumatized after what happened at the night. I think what happened was her son had crossed over and she didn't realize her son had died and she was still searching for him. So I was trying to let her know that he wasn't there anymore and that he had crossed over and trying to let her know, let her spirit know that he had crossed over. So a friend of mine who's also a spirit medium, and I got him on the phone and I was talking to him and I said to him, what do you think? And he tried to connect with her and she wouldn't listen to him. So we were both trying to connect with her and we both realized that we felt that we should try and help her cross over. Now, it's not something that we would always do and would not recommend to do, you know, unless you're aware of it. And I wouldn't do it again because it was probably a bad idea. At the time, I felt it was the right thing to do because she was so frantic and desperate that I felt like the only way she could be with her son was to help her cross over and be with him. I felt at the time that she was stuck on the vessel and that she was trapped and all she was her spirit was going round and round and round and round and she was stuck on this vessel trying to find her son and she was in this terrible loop and that she was going to do this for the rest of her life, in whatever this loop was, and that she was never going to find peace. And it was, I could feel her torment and her pain and it was so tragic that I felt I had to help her cross over so she could be with her son. And that was, I felt, the only option at the time. So I decided to try and help her cross over. I started the process of trying to help her cross over. And when I started that process, another spirit got involved, which was the spirit of this man who I believed was her husband, that I believed was a really negative spirit. For whatever reason, that he was trapping her there. So I was trying to get her to cross over. And every time she tried to cross over, she was afraid of him and he was trapping her there. So we went back and forth between the two spirits. And every time she'd get halfway over, he'd pull her back. So it was such a traumatic thing to try and get her to go over. And he kept pulling her back and he kept pulling her back. I was trying so hard with, at the time, like I said, my friend, my other psychic medium friend was Lewis. And we were both trying to help her cross over. And he would keep trying to stop her. So finally, with all of our energy, tried to help her cross over. And finally, we got her over. And the minute we got her over, there was this whole peace on that area. It was like all the trauma just left and all the peace, this peace just came over that whole area. But everybody was so upset. Everybody could feel the trauma. Everybody could feel the sadness. And all of a sudden, it's like everything just left. It was crazy. So we were all relieved. We were all really happy. It was like everything was good. Everybody was happy that she was at peace. Everything was good. So finally, our time was up. I brought the group back up to the main deck where all the other groups that had done investigating in other parts of the ships, we all met up at the top of the main deck. And I was like exhausted from this. And so I was just like, oh my God. So I was telling another investigator what happened. And he said, Sam Baltrusis, actually, I talked to him.
Sam Baltrusis is, he's a medium. Is he a psychic or a medium?
He's a psychic.
He's an author. He's a paranormal historian, and he writes a ton of great books.
He's an author, yeah.
But he also is an empath or a psychic or however you want to label him. And he's been on TV a lot like you as well. So just, yeah, for the people listening. And Sam will be on the show at some point, too.
So I went back down and with him and a couple of other people, and we went down to check out to see, you know, I was just telling him what happened when I was down there. He wanted to see where it was. I told him what happened. And as I was talking about it, he saw a big shadow come up behind me. Now, we went down. There was nobody there in the mess hall. And it was completely empty. Everybody was gone. So it was dead quiet. So we went down the long corridor, down to the far end of the ship. Went down. So as he was talking to me, his face changed. He saw this big dark shadow come up behind me. And I was like, what's going on? He's like, oh my God, there's this big black shadow coming up behind you. So I was like, what the hell? So I was like, all right, I don't like that. So then two other people arrived and I kept hearing this squeak on the floor, squeak, 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 like it was a sneaker. And I couldn't figure out where it was coming from. So these other two guys arrived and I had a backpack with me. So I went over. We were supposed to stay overnight on the ship. That was the other thing. So I had a sleeping bag. I had everything with me. We were supposed to stay where I don't know where that area is called. You know, when they're bunk beds where they sleep. And so I went over and all of a sudden I got this really negative feeling. And I was like, I don't like it in here. I think we need to go. So I went over and all of a sudden I heard this buzzing coming from my backpack. And I was like, what the hell is that? So I opened my backpack. My electric toothbrush had switched on. So we all started laughing. We were like, oh, you know. So I turned it off. I closed my backpack. And all of a sudden I got this dreaded feeling like something really negative had just come up from I don't know what side of me. And I was like, something's here. I just was like, I need to get the hell out of here. And I turned around and all of a sudden, whatever it was came right up behind me and started chasing me. And I'm not kidding you. I don't run. I do not run unless something's on fire. Like, I'm not a runner. Like I said, I'm not athletic. I took off. It felt like this big thing had come up behind me and was chasing me. And Sam goes, run. He's like, just run. And I was like, what? And I just started running. And I could feel like as I was running down the corridor, like of this ship. Now, people are coming in my other direction. I'm knocking them out of the way. I'm like, get out of my way. And I could feel like there was this big, dark entity behind me, like with its hands out, like coming towards my neck. I'm not kidding you. No lie. The negativity, like this thing wanted to choke me. And I started running. I've never in my life felt this in my whole entire life. I could not get up that ladder stairs. I got to the end. I was screaming. I ran up the stairs out. I started crying hysterically. I'm not scared of anything. And anyone will tell you, I've gone to all kinds of scary places. I'm the first one in. I'll be like, I'll go down to the basement. I'm not scared. I got up to the top part of the deck and I was in hysterics. I was so terrified that thing was still after me when I got up to the top deck. I was hyperventilating.
Episode 15. That was a great episode called Afraid of Exploring the Unexplained with my friend Jeff Belanger. But really, what I remembered out of this, it was during COVID and I was unable to see my girls. They were quarantined for a month or so. So I actually got them remotely to do the intro. So this is really my favorite introduction of probably all the episodes. Okay, so I'm here with a couple special guests, two little girls, two big girls that I've been quarantined from. Hello, Emily. Hello, Carly.
Hello, this is Carly Heskey.
And I'm Emily Heskey, the star of the Afraid of Nothing movie.
You can see my brilliant sister in the documentary on Amazon Prime and VidiSpace.
You can also buy great stuff from the Afraid of Nothing podcast store.
I got a shirt.
And I got a notebook to write my next screenplay.
check the show notes. Oh, and my dad is crazy. Love you, Dad.
Love you, Dad.
Mwah.
Episode 7 is with paranormal podcast icon. I think the guy that really deserves more credit than I don't even know if he gets, but he was the guy that started in 2005, 2006, and really got me hooked. His name is Jim Harold. It was an honor to have him on the show. And Jim talked about one of his scariest campfire tales ever.
So, Jim, so you have two shows, the Paranormal Podcast and the Jim Harold Campfire. Being a host for 15 years or so of a podcast, you've probably heard it all. Are there a couple campfire stories that come to mind that you just had never heard before and that totally stuck with you after you were done listening to it?
Well, this one's a little lengthy, but the one that comes foremost to mind is the Roadhouse Saloon. If you want me to, I can try to, as briefly as possible, retell that one. But this is basically...
Yeah, please.
Okay. Well, this is worthy of a Twilight Zone episode. So this focuses around our listener, T.I., who was calling in from Michigan, and she told a story about when she was in Wisconsin and her and a male friend went to see a band. It was in a rural area. It was at a bar, and they went to see them. They closed down the place, and they were talking to the band afterwards because they were musicians as well. And they started to go back to their home area, which was about an hour away. T.I., my caller, she told her friend Bob, she said, I've got to go to the restroom. And he kind of looked around as they're driving and said, well, unless you want to avail yourself of one of these bushes, you know, you're going to have to wait. And she said, no, just drive fast. So all of a sudden, maybe 10, 15 minutes down the road, they see this bar wide open, neon signs, cars in a parking lot. You could even kind of hear the music. The joint was jumping, as they say, and had a sign called the Roadhouse Saloon. So they went and they said, well, that's weird. It would be open now, but let's not look a gift horse in the mouth. We'll go in. And Bob had mentioned, you know, actually, I'd love to go in this place. Never been there. I heard about this great old West mural that had been created and is well known. And he was an artist as well. So he was curious about that. So they went in and everybody was kind of like not talking, but they were kind of smiling at them. They kind of got a weird vibe, but they thought, oh, well, you know, whatever. So Bob goes and gets them both one drink from the bar, beer, and T.I. goes to take care of the call of nature. And Bob is admiring this huge old West mural. And they're sitting there drinking and basically when, and if you do, by the way, folks, one of the hazards of this is when the neighbor dog walks by working out of a home studio. So yeah. If you hear a dog bleeding in, and just know that the neighbor's dog is walking by. Anyhow, so continuing on with the story. So they were looking around and the people were kind of weird, were kind of strange. They just kind of been smiling and kind of just strange. And they looked around, they saw this mural, and they noticed that the people in the mural were the same people in the bar. They thought, that's weird. God. And they're talking to each other and say, well, maybe these are regulars, right? And the artist did this as like an homage to them. So then comes up this guy. And they have this old jukebox, this Wurlitzer-style jukebox that plays actual records. You know, the bubbler type, you know what I'm talking about, probably.
Yep.
He puts on Chubby Checker's Let's Twist Again. And he asks T.I. to dance. And T.I., you know, had no interest. This guy was kind of gnarly looking. He had kind of rotten teeth. It was not a good look. And she had a cane and she showed it to him and she said she was really happy because she walks with a cane. She was really happy she had that cane because that gave her excuse to say no. So anyway, they continue to talk and admire and realize that these people are kind of strange, but hey, you know what, whatever. And they're looking at the mural and they notice the double doors, the swinging doors, like in the old TV Westerns, where's Bart? Where's the sheriff? I want to see him. I want to have a showdown. You know, when he comes through the saloon doors.
Yeah.
And they had noticed before they were just the doors there, but they looked at it again and they noticed there were what looked like some misty figures coming into view. And they thought that was weird. That wasn't there a minute ago. And they noticed that one is a tall man and one appears to be a shorter woman. And it's starting to develop in as like a Polaroid picture. And it, more definition. Yeah. The woman has curly hair. T.I. has curly hair. And the male is much taller. Bob is much taller than T.I. And then develops a little more and they notice that the woman has boots. T.I. has boots on. Then they notice the woman has a cane. And at that point, Bob and T.I. look at each other and say, let's get out of here.
Oh, God.
Because we don't know what's happened.
We doppelgangers. Yeah.
So wow. Anyway, they go to go out. They close the door and the whole place goes black.
Oh,
like it
God.
Was dead stone cold. And they turn around and look at the parking lot. And there is a car, a singular car in the parking lot, their car. So they drive off and you would think, boy, that's a wild story. But it even gets wilder because T.I. is a very brave person. And she decides to come back a couple days later with her sister, I think it was, or a friend. They go about 7 or 8 o'clock at night. They weren't going to chance it at 1 or 2 in the morning or 3 in the morning like this happened. And they go in and sure enough, the mural is there and there's a jukebox. But the jukebox is a modern CD jukebox. And, oh, by the way, no chubby checker. They go and talk to the bartender, who's a woman. T.I. says, you know, the other night, there was this big, burly, good-looking bartender in here. Where's he at? And she's like, we don't have any bartender like that in here. All we have is myself and my elderly father. And with that, T.I. figured she wasn't going to figure it out. She left. She never came back again to the Roadhouse Saloon. And I got to say, maybe if they had stayed there when they saw that misty figure, who knows? Maybe they would have gotten trapped. And here is the kicker. The kicker to that even is this place really exists. Listeners have gone and they've taken pictures. The mural exists. It is a real place. So while I've talked to T.I. at length, on multiple occasions, she seems very sincere. Her story doesn't change, and the place is real. And that's what I can tell you about the Roadhouse Saloon. That's my favorite all-time campfire story.
That's incredible. That sounds like a time slip, doesn't it? Sounds kind of like they kind of, yeah.
It does, doesn't it? I mean, it is just weird. It is just very, very strange.
Episode 23 is with good friend Kyle Carver, who's after this became a sometimes co-host. But Kyle had a great episode called Afraid of My Past Salem Life. And in this clip, he talks about some of his acting experiences and also a record he holds on one of the most iconic paranormal or horror shows series of all time. You know, one question I have for you as an actor, which is more intimidating, doing an audition or walking onto the set of like The Walking Dead and being with the live actors for your first day on the set?
Well, it's, you know, over the years that answer has definitely changed. Walking onto sets is, or I should say was pretty scary. Like there's still a little bit of nerves going into it because you don't know who you're basically going to be working with in a way, especially when, you know, I'm not the star of a show or anything. So I'm basically walking into other people's shows. And you never know what kind of egos you have to deal with or personalities. Thankfully, the majority of people that I've worked with have all been really cool. So, and same with auditions. They can be, depending on the project, sometimes it's scary, sometimes it's not. But that's all, you know, it's self-pressure. And it's like a little story that the Tom Cruise movie that I did, American Made. If I had, I was a lazy actor, is what I should say. For that one, I didn't even look up the movie that I was auditioning for, which is like kind of a big no-no for some actors. They're like, how can you not research what you're auditioning for? But I got in this mindset of like, when I started looking up to seeing who was on the project, then my nerves would start because I'd, you know, want to be on that project, obviously, for a chance to work with Tom Cruise. So I didn't even look it up. And even when I booked it, I didn't know what it was. And I didn't know I was working with Tom Cruise until the day that I arrived on the set. So then obviously I start to get a little nervous because I just have no idea what to expect. But thankfully I'm like an old cranky actor now. So it's like the audition process and, you know, going on to something new, it's not really nerves anymore. It's more just excitement than anything else. Yeah.
So how did the Tom Cruise scene go? You're in a cockpit with him, right? So how was that? Did that go pretty normal? Did you have extra takes or was it pretty smooth?
No, it was actually really smooth. The process was pretty simple. We were in and out in, I want to say, 3 to 4 hours. We just had this one scene. And I was actually really impressed with Tom because, so the scene is basically we're doing a pre-flight, uh, pre-flight checklist. And for the audition, I have this five or six things that I'm going down this checklist. And Tom Cruise's kind of, his responses are check, check. Yep, ready to go. Simple, simple responses to simple things like windows, landing gear. Yeah, it's up. So it was relatively simple. But then on the day we're filming, the director, Doug Liman, he's like, let's just lose the script. Let's go with the actual checklist, which I conveniently had right in front of me in the cockpit. So I basically literally read the actual list. Meanwhile, Tom Cruise, he has to learn on the spot the correct responses to each of these. And it's not yes, ready to go. It's like some of them were kind of complicated. So he had to like literally learn these responses. And he did it in like 5 to 10 minutes. And I was impressed with how quick he did that. But I guess, you know, that's why he's Tom Cruise, I guess. So
well, he's a pilot too, right? He flies. Is he a pilot as well?
I'm not sure. He might be. That would make sense.
Yeah.
That would make sense.
So there you go. Now, for trivia fans of The Walking Dead, you want to tell them your little kind of record that you hold on The Walking Dead?
Oh, yeah. Well, Walking Dead is like the highlight of my career, personally, like my personal goals. So I have the dubious record of the most kills by a non-main character. And I think it's 34, this little record that I even know about. But, you know, the fans of the show, they keep track of that stuff. So
episode 25 is the most unbelievably downloaded by far, probably by 6 or 7 times more than the next closest episode of all time. And that was Afraid of Contacting Your Pet on the Other Side with Rob Guttrow, who's been on 5 or 6 times and always draws a crowd. This one was interesting. It was our first time talking about communicating with your pets who have passed. And I included one of my skeptical best friends, Dan Miller. And the result was, well, Dan was surprised. Welcome back. As I teased earlier in the program, I did ask Rob to connect with one of my friends, one of my best friends, Dan Miller, who went to school with me at Indiana University. We were fraternity brothers. We've stayed pretty much best friends since then. And Dan lost a dog, Charlie, in the past year. And so Dan sent Rob a picture and his name. Rob did a download, had a conversation with Dan, and this is the results. Dan called me and gave me a recap. Hey, Dan Miller, thank you for calling in. You just talked to Rob Guttrow, the pet medium. How'd it go?
Well, it was good, Bob. I was very surprised and kind of enlightened, I think is the best way to put it, from some of the things he said. It just is, by sending him a picture and Charlie's name, I really wasn't sure what to expect. You know, maybe a lot of generic stuff that could apply to anything. And to a certain extent, that was true only just by the way dogs behave. But he nailed down a couple of things that it's hard to explain. Who would have known him except for me and the dog? One of the, you know, kind of the basic questions I asked was, like, if, you know, what was her favorite toy? And he mentioned a duck that she would carry around the house and that it was a squeaky toy. And I immediately thought, well, I do remember a pig that was a squeaky toy that we played with constantly. And another big kind of stuffed duck that she carried and she would fetch. And he mentioned a couple of other ones, but he said that. And then I tied those two together. Well, after the conversation, as I was driving, I had to take a picture of what's actually been on my dashboard for, gosh, I don't know, 6 months or so. It's a smaller duck that she used to carry. And because that's what I kind of thought of with her is what I want to keep around to remind me of her. And I checked, and sure enough, that little duck also had a squeaker device.
Wow.
And and part of his comment was the duck that used to squeak, and it didn't really hit me until it all came over me, like, how would he know that? And there it was, or it's been there for me, and it's just a constant reminder of her and the bond we shared. To look at what he said it was far from generic. It was very specific, and it really made me feel good about the whole day, and really every day that I've seen that duck and noticed it or seen it and forgotten that it was there.
You know, that shows you picked the right toy. What about in terms of, you had a question, I think, on when she was passing. Any information on that?
Yeah, and that's kind of the other thing that really was a very specific thing. She was a big dog, 100 pounds, a mastiff bloodhound mix, and very loyal and always around. And as age, you know, came upon her, she kind of had a hard time getting around. And her belly started hanging low. We took her to the vet for another reason, and the vet said, hey, this is really going on with your dog. It has Cushing's disease, which is where the abdomen kind of loses its muscular tension and starts to disintegrate, and sometimes some of their internal organs start hanging low, and they're a lot more sensitive and things like that. Well, in the end, he mentioned that she told him she had pains in her stomach, and obviously that was it, and that's what she passed from ultimately. But in the last few days, week or so, he had mentioned that she communicated to him that she had a pain in her right leg and her hip. And I'm kind of breaking up a little, because that's the last week or so, she couldn't walk and her right leg started swelling up. Wow. And we got anti-inflammatory medication from the vet to try and make it subside so we could get her in and do some other treatment. And then, you know, in the end just came quicker than what we thought. But there's nobody else that knew that except for my ex-wife. And for that to be something that she communicated, she knew that there wasn't anything that was taking her away from us that we hadn't tried to correct. She said she knew that it was her time, it wasn't my fault, that kind of thing. But to zero in on her discomfort for the last few days without knowing anything about it, I mean, it really just caused me to smile and start crying, and almost like I was able to give her a hug and pet her and say, I'll see you soon, or I'll see you someday, you know? So anyway, those really just a very great, a great phone call. It's a great feeling, and I've been kind of swimming around in it all day, and I will for several days, I'm sure.
And that was it. An amazing job, really. Beyond those things that Dan pointed out after we talked, he mentioned one other thing that really resonated with him was that Rob knew that he had adopted Charlie right around age one. And actually, Dan had adopted Charlie at age 11 months. So he was shocked, too, that Rob would know that he didn't get the dog as a puppy or from the beginning. There were other things as well. Just an amazing job and connection. And it really was an affirmation that made Dan feel well and just kind of a tribute to Rob's capabilities. So there. Testimonial, man. He's good. Back to the show. Episode 32, Afraid of the Science of Ghost Hunters, was with Brandon J. Alvis. And this guy is someone who is really going places. He was on Ghost Hunter for a couple of years, but what he's doing now is even more amazing. And I was so happy to have Brandon on the show to talk about what he feels is the science behind ghost hunting and something that's missing in many paranormal shows today. Going to your paranormal side now, look, you had, unfortunately, a tragic loss of two brothers, which sort of propelled you onto your paranormal journey. Do you mind sharing that with our audience?
Yeah, and you know, in 1995, I lost my oldest brother to cancer. 2004, I lost another brother to suicide. And that kind of sent me on my journey into the unexplained, the paranormal, if you will. I was never really having experiences in the paranormal as a kid or really had a ghostly experience per se. It was about the fact that I had to grow up at a very young age and learn about the possibility of a life after death. And I've always looked into the science side of it. And the science side of it always says, from Einstein and other, you know, scientists, say that energy is neither created nor destroyed. And that's something I've always believed in. So my question is, if there are ghosts, if there are entities, whatever you want to call them, if they do exist, are they made up of the energy within ourselves, right? We have neurons firing off in our brain. We're made up of energy as people. Where does that energy go when we die? And does it retain consciousness? That's the question I'm looking for, and something that I continue to look for this day. Every day I look for it. Every day I talk about it. And it's something that's a lifelong journey for me.
I read or heard somewhere about your theory about how ghosts manifest in photon events, and that there are theories that photons contain consciousness. Can you kind of elaborate on that a bit?
Absolutely. So since 2006, I founded the American Paranormal Research Association, and I've been very lucky to consult scientists, medical doctors, engineers, people from various technical industries that can help me remain grounded in scientific principle. And one of those people is Dr. Harry Klor. He's the only person in history to receive two PhDs simultaneously in any discipline. And when I approached him, I asked him, I said, if ghosts are real and they exist, from your scientific opinion, how would they manifest? And he threw out the theory of photon events. So I got my hands on what's called an electron multiplying camera, an EMCCD camera, that's used mainly by the digital imaging scientific community to record single photon events. And these are light events. And you talk about the brilliant mathematician, Dr. Penrose, a man that's studied physics and space and everything you can imagine. He believes that photons do retain consciousness. And so I took this camera into a few very reportedly haunted locations and utilized that camera in those spaces. And I collected some very significant footage, which I would consider a breakthrough, right? So not only do we collect photon events in these places where people report to have ghostly phenomena, but I think that if you look at Dr. Penrose and his theory, Dr. Klor's theory and others' theories, I think that there's something to the mechanics behind the manifestation of what we perceive to be ghosts as photon events.
So that's really cool. You're looking outside of the paranormal field rather than them inventing these spirit boxes or whatever in their living room or their garage. So you actually go to other respected fields and gather the data and get it acknowledged by them for your paranormal research.
Absolutely. Because, you know, we are in a space that is so overrun by entertainment, right? So overrun by these people that have been on television for a decade or more in some instances that are utilizing these devices to make a 42-minute show, right? We understand that. They need to have results to continue their popularity and continue to have results for their financial gain, whatever it may be, whatever you want to call it. But the fact is, if we want to move forward and step out of the shadow of pseudoscience, we have to open ourselves to third-party, you know, speculation, third-party analysis. And if we don't do that, we will never be taken seriously, not only by the public, but the scientific community. And that's something I'm very passionate about.
That's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. What's your methodology? So you've been to over 200 locations, and we'll ask what some of your scariest ones are. Probably questions you've asked a million times, but when you go to a location, is your methodology the same for a prison versus a hospital versus a residential home, or do you just like scope it out and then map out your methodology and take a day or two to figure that out?
You know, my methodology is always the same. You know, that's one thing that this field needs to adapt is ethics, standards, and protocol, right? And methodology as well. Because if we don't adapt that, again, we'll never be taken seriously by not only the scientific community, but the public as well. Because if we want to step out of the shadow of pseudoscience and this whole idea of this public perception of just entertainment, we have to adapt a series of ethics, protocol, and methodology. And for me, I've been very lucky to talk to these various professionals from technical industries that really helped me remain grounded in scientific principle as well as this methodology. And it's the same for me everywhere I go because it's about empirical evidence and factual data. If we don't have empirical evidence and factual data, we don't have anything because it's all entertainment at that point. So that's something I'm very passionate about and so that I always want to push forward.
How long does it take you to gather there? Because it's you get a spirit box and you play it back like, ooh, there's a voice, you know? How do you like deal with gathering data? How long does it take you once you go to a location and you gather the data? How long does it take, you know, afterwards to analyze it and see if you've come up with something?
Well, first off, the spirit box is a complete joke, in my opinion, and something that is completely contaminated by human frequencies, radio frequencies, cell phone frequencies, things of that nature. But for me, outside of the show Ghost Hunters, I've looked at locations and observed locations for over a decade, one of which is the McConaughey Estate in San Lorenzo, California, just outside of Oakland. I've been investigating that location for over 10 years. And that's a place that I'm very passionate about, a place that I have a lot of data associated with. And anytime I collect something from a device that is not made in someone's garage, a device that is not made by someone looking for ghosts or entities, whatever you want to call them, I have to have that looked at by a third party. And that third party has to be from a technical industry, be that a scientist, an engineer, whatever it may be. I have to have that looked at. So to me, this can take years, many years sometimes. You see the show Ghost Hunters, we go to a location, we're there for probably 5 days at times. We investigate for a number of nights, but that's not the end of the story. That case continues after what you see on television. So it can take a lot of time, a lot of years at times. So, television can be one thing, but an actual case is another.
Episode 34, Afraid of a Seance Revisited, Death Walker and Fear-tober, was with another icon, Nick Groff. Nick spent time with me talking about the early days of ghost adventures.
You mentioned Nevada. You were born in California, but you were raised in New England. And then you spent some time in Nevada, I think, in your college years. And that's actually where you met Zach Baggins, which is kind of an interesting story, right? He was your DJ at your wedding. Is that true?
Yeah. So when I was married way back then, it was interesting because I found his website. It was like Vegas Voltage or something back then. And it was just interesting how we came about to know each other. And yeah, he was a wedding DJ. And basically, I started talking about films and stuff, and he did. And I was putting together a bunch of projects and everything that I was working on back then. I knew Aaron for a long time. He snuck into one of my college classes. I was attending UNLV, University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
Yeah. Right? Oh, God,
graduated
cool.
there, and yeah. That was the reason I moved to Las Vegas in 99. Graduated in 2004, met Aaron in like 2001, I think, and we were just working on tons of stuff together. And
what was your major? What were you majoring in?
Film.
Film, okay,
so I graduated
cool.
with higher honors in film. Yeah, and I don't know, I worked with my film instructor on a bunch of stuff. I made my first movie, Malevolence, in 2004. I went to CineVegas Film Festival when Dennis Hopper was alive and running that. It actually screened next to the movie Napoleon Dynamite when
wow.
no one even knew what that film was. Yeah, I remember seeing it in the theater at the Palms Hotel there in Vegas, and everyone's like, oh, this movie's dumb. And I'm like, this movie is genius.
Yeah, absolutely.
Huge. Then I became huge. It was awesome. But I was so excited about that film festival because – not because my film got accepted and played there, but also it was one of the greatest like lineups for that film festival that I've ever seen. David Lynch was there with Dennis Hopper, and they played Blue Velvet.
Oh my God.
They also played on the big screen Eraserhead.
Oh.
Like if no one's ever seen Eraserhead, that's like film at its finest back then. And listening to David Lynch talk, it was funny. Funny story, we got up because we had to leave because they were going over in their Q&A, and I really want to see Miike Takahashi's Gozu that just came out. It was screening next door in the next theater. And we're like, man, we're going to miss it. It was running like 10 minutes over. I'm like, all right, we got to get up and leave. And everyone's listening patiently. And my cousin Justin and I, we get up and we're leaving. We're walking out. And David Lynch goes, are we not interesting enough for you? Everyone just looked at us. And I was like, you know what? I respect that, and I take that as a compliment. And I was like, no, we're just going to we're trying to hurry up and see Gozu, Miike Takahashi next door. And he just – it was really funny. I was like, wow. Man, we just got called out by David Lynch.
Oh, that's crazy. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds like a crazy time having Zach Baggins be your DJ and then going to do that. How did you and Zach Baggins start up a conversation about ghosts at your wedding? Was it just kind of like – did it just – you took a break from dancing or something or what? How did they just
– No, it was nothing like that. Basically, long story short – that happened, I'm talking like months later. Basically, I said, I need someone else to shoot a second camera. And I, at the time, I was doing a ton of production work. I had my own camera and I was working for companies and I was shooting a bunch of wedding videos, and I actually hired him to shoot second camera and stuff for me. And I was putting all this stuff together, and I basically one day, I think it was around October 2004, I was sitting in my apartment and I was watching a special on the Sally House. The news reporter did that documentary that came out where the guy got scratched on camera, and I saw that.
Yeah.
And all my life I've been fascinated with the ghost, paranormal. My grandmother used to talk about it when I was a kid. I used to be really big into aliens, like I said, and UFOs. And I used to explore haunted locations through high school, and my cousin used to take me to monasteries and like huge, crazy areas in the woods and all this fog rolling through. Like, just, we used to do that stuff all the time, exploring different places. So one day I was watching that Sally House special and I said, I want to go see if ghosts really exist. That was me back when I was 24 years old, you know? And I said, you know what? I have a camera. I know how to push the red button on the camera. I have some mini DV tapes. I have no money, but I'm excited to get out there. I'll pick up another job at CompUSA, which I did, selling electronics. And then basically I call Zach up and I say, hey man, let's go look for ghosts. What do you think about it? And the thing is not a lot of people know that I actually took a spring break trip a couple years prior to doing this, calling him up. And I went up to all the locations. I went up to Virginia City, Nevada. I drove all the way up there. I checked out the town of Rachel. I went to Area 51 as close as I could get, obviously. Went to Tonopah, drove through Goldfield. And I just remember walking on the boardwalk saying, this is an amazing place. So years later, here we are. And I said, let's take a drive up to all these haunted mine towns and let's just film everything. I'm like, we're going to need one more camera. If it's like you and me, we're filming everything. Let's go out there and explore. He got really excited based on my passion, and he started telling me a story how he had an experience back in Michigan and stuff. And I said, cool, I got the perfect guy. He's funny. He's a good camera guy. He's great. A good friend of mine. And then that's how I introduced Aaron to him. And that was that. We got in his little Scion back then, and we drove up to all the haunted locations and just started filming everything. We had tons and tons of mini DV tapes back then. And it was weird. I started molding it together and I said, wow, there's something special here based on some of the evidence we got. And I didn't know what the heck we were doing, to be honest with you. I didn't even know what a documentary was back then, like putting one together or putting a narrative with a story. And I just started molding it and I started just driving it. And then my buddy who made my other film, he could, you know, compose music. So I had him layer some weird music down to add to like all the elements. And I just started telling a story based around evidence that we collected that I thought was pretty incredible. And then the news got a hold of it. That happened. And I said, man, I want everybody to see this in the world. So I actually got one of those stupid Hollywood agency books back then. Remember those things?
Oh, like a directory of all the, the people you should, you should charge an arm and a leg for that. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like no good, right? You pay like $40 and you're like, what the heck?
It's like a phone book of nobody that'll talk to you.
That was me. That was me 100 calls later. No joke. 100 calls later, I got really good at being like, hey, you got to check out this documentary. It's amazing. It's called Ghost Adventures, and this is what it is, and blah, blah, blah. And I go on until they would be like, all right, sounds good. Just send it to us from your agent or your lawyer. We can't take unsolicited material. I was like, what?
Yeah.
Well, that's why I'm calling you. I'm like, that's why I'm calling you. So I got hung up on, or I got told that, and you know, it was funny, but it was like, I'm just a passionate individual and I pretty much go the distance and try my best until like all fails, right? So I got this one person to be like, all right, just send it to me. And I'm like, no, I'm not sending it to you. I will drive it to you and I will put it in your DVD player and I will show it to you in person. So I convinced him and he allowed us. And that was just a weird situation. It was like Mulholland Drive. I drove there the next day. I had to convince Zach to go and all that stuff. And basically I came up with the name Ghost Adventures. I said, we need to call it Adventure, put the title on, said Ghost, and we call it Ghost Adventures. And basically showed him, showed someone else. That got to Sci-Fi, aired on Sci-Fi. We had some deal for 7 air days back in 2007, and it did like 1.2 million viewerships on like a Friday night. It was insane. And that's when like MySpace, internet was around. It just kind of blew up, went viral.
Yeah.
And that kind of lingered to some contact he had, Zach did, and that got us this other, you know, deal with travel. The rest is history. So, weird.
That's amazing. That's a very cool backstory. You mentioned Mulholland Drive, so that whole David Lynch thing comes full circle again.
Yeah, I know.
You know?
Wrapping up the best of the top 50, well, at least from my experience, even though I felt all were great, but you gotta cherry pick somewhere, is episode 48, Afraid of a Cult and Demons, with Michelle Belanger.
I don't even know if you remember it. There was an older YouTube video where you talked about that dark is in the eye of the beholder. And then you put it in context with what happened kind of with on the death of Socrates and with Moses. Mm-hmm. Do you mind sharing that? Because really demons before, you know, in the current context, they're bad, but they didn't have to be bad. They were just non-human before. Could you just add a little color to that for us?
Absolutely. So our word demon comes from the Greek word daemon, and we interface with the word demon based on sort of the mythology that's grown up about it. within our culture, at which point it is a very Christian take. There are angels, there are demons. Demons are necessarily the scions of hell. They are after human souls. They're basically evil personified. But the word demon in Greek was more about a being that existed in this sort of hazy space between humans and the gods, a little bit closer to the Hindu idea of devas and asuras, which are sometimes presented as cognates for angels and demons, but it's not a one-for-one. And the best way to put demon, at least the Greek concept of demon, into context is that Socrates believed that he had a personal demon. He was not unique in this. Greek daemons were a little bit like guardian angels or spirit guides. People could have one of these beings looking out for them and looking after them and offering guidance throughout their life. And you could have a eudaimonis, a good demon, or you could have a kakodaimonis. And that's not necessarily a bad demon, but it's a demon of chaos, a being who was more likely to be kind of a trickster and would lead you astray, mostly for, I don't know if I can say that, for shins and giggles.
I have a beep sound effect. I've had to use it a couple times. That's okay. That's good.
I caught myself, though. Anyway, so eudaimonis and kakodaimonis were the things of good. And so think more order versus chaos rather than good versus malevolent or evil. When Socrates was condemned to death for misleading the youth of Athens, there's a whole political thing that people can go read up about that. Socrates got the raw end of the deal, and he was condemned to drink hemlock in front of the assembly. And the day on which he was going to do this public execution, he notes that his daemon never spoke against what was going on. And from that, he took that death was not necessarily a bad thing because his personal daemon had never misled him and had always warned him if he was going to go down a path that was destructive. So understanding that in the ancient world, what people meant by demon or even angel is not the same as what we understand it to be now is a significant part of that academic background. If we go back even further, our idea of demons comes very much from the ancient Middle East and what we think of as the cradle of Western civilization. So Mesopotamia, so you know the Tigris, Euphrates River, all the way over there. And most of what we understand about possession and exorcism, demonic obsession, comes from their beliefs and their practices. But if you read what they meant by demons as well, many of the things that they were identifying as demons were actually gods or were the children of gods and were simply behaving in ways that either brought destruction or disease to humanity. So it was a matter of, well, without going too far into it, I think it's important to understand that the words we use change over time. And part of understanding the occult and the paranormal means understanding the anthropology and the folklore behind the words that we've chosen and what those words are supposed to represent, as well as the stories that have been told that not only are stories of experiencers, but are stories of media, stories of pop culture, because all of those things feed into our perception of these and what we mean when we start to use the terms. So demon's a really complicated one. And when I use it, it's not always in the sense of, Satan's little helpers that are out to eat people's souls, because it's so much more than that.
You always see on movies and in TV, you need to know the demon's name to cast it out. Is that true? Do you need to know the demon's name to cast it out?
Well, I don't know if I would strictly say that it is true, but it is definitely something that is consistent throughout folklore, particularly from Mesopotamia on. It was a significant part of the exorcism rituals that come down to us from Sumer and Babylon, where the names of these beings gave a person the power to compel and banish and bind them, as well as to summon them. And there is a rich vein of literature that comes down to us from that. Renaissance Europe, it's the Solomonic tradition and sort of the roots of ceremonial magic, like picks that up and makes a real big to-do of it, where it's not just a name, but each demon has a sigil and a metal and different astrological associations. And all of these are things that then give you basically the key to controlling them and either calling them up to ask them for favors or sending them away to banish and exorcise them. So the names are really important, especially in our Western mythological tradition. Now, is that a true fact? It's certainly a widespread one, and it's reflected in stories from the Bible all the way back.
Now, this might be a dumb question, but who names a demon? Is there a master demon that names them? Who actually gives them the name?
You know, there is no point in the literature that I have read that suggests that they got the name beyond, like, the name is their being, like it's what they came into existence with. And I think, okay, so I'm going to say I have not read any primary materials that say a demon got named this by an archdemon or whatever. Their names are simply presented as this is its name.
It's just kind of a Big Bang thing, right? There's no before. They come into existence and they have that name, basically. Okay.
Well, no, implied in that is that the name is its essence. And it's actually that's an incredibly insightful question. And I love it because if you go back to Sumer and Babylon, what their name is the thing that they do. Mm. It's really important to understand that ancient demons, it's impossible to separate theology from medicine in the way that they looked at these things, because a lot of the ancient demons were literally diseases, were literally psychological problems. So the demon of tetanus, his name was tetanus, or you know, the Greek or the Sumerian word for tetanus. And people who were possessed by that demon, who were affected by that demon, literally just had tetanus. So the way that they looked at the world, they had no idea of germs or germ theory. What they saw was someone whose body was just starting to lock up to the point where their back would bow and the back of their head would meet their heels in the worst part of this, you know, where the progression of the tetanus disease. And so they named that tetanus. I'm not going to off the top of my head rattle off the Greek name for the tetanus demon, but just it's a translation for tetanus.
So a name is almost like a preordained fate for a demon, and you really can't change them. They are who they are, and you can't even kind of cure that or even send them into the light, can you, or what?
The idea is the name is what they are and what they do and the essential nature of them. And it's that essential nature is why having it is a talisman. It gives you power and gives you an idea of what their capabilities are. And so yeah, the general idea of demons, and this is both from like the folklore, the mythology, as well as I'd say modern widespread sentiment, is that they came into being and you can't really kill them. You can banish them, you can send them away, you can bind them, but you cannot end them.
Wrapping up is... Well, ads. I did ads. I never sold anything with these ads for Allswell mattresses, but there was a lot of fun to do. It was a coworker with me named Annabelle Mallon that did this also during COVID. We did it distance. We did it from a distance. She was holed up in New York, which was kind of like a petri dish for COVID, and I was in Massachusetts. So you have to have fun somehow. And we did these, and I thought she did a great job. So thought I'd share it again because kind of one of my favorites.
Hello, listeners. I want to play a game. But first, a disturbing interruption to our podcast.
Whoa, you must be the new roommate. What's your name?
Annabelle.
Hi, Annabelle. What are you doing on my Allswell mattress?
I need to possess it.
Yeah, hey, look, I get it. Allswell mattresses are the best. Its hybrid mattress technology gives you the comfort of memory foam with the support of individually wrapped coils, all at a really great price.
Allswell.
Yeah, you got it. You can even try it for 100 nights, risk-free. And if you're not satisfied with the sleep that you're getting, simply ship it back. Plus, every Allswell mattress comes with a 10-year limited warranty. So if you ever have any problems, you don't have to worry about being stuck in bed hell. There's only one problem. You need to get your own. Oh, and you get free shipping on your first All's Well mattress simply by following the link in the show notes. It helps support the podcast.
Never be afraid of a good night's sleep.
All's Well.
And now, back to our horrific program.
And with that, we say good night and sleep well, loyal listeners. We'll be back with the second half, the best of the rest from episodes 51 to 99. In the meantime, check out the show notes, support the show, and you can also watch the documentary Afraid of Nothing, which is now on Prime Video. So rent it, buy it, and leave a review. Thank you for all that you do.
You've been listening to the Afraid of Nothing podcast. Please subscribe and like us on Facebook. Until next time, stay scared.
Hey, you're still here? Great. Then why not listen to another episode? Visit afraidofnothingpodcast.com to peruse all the shows. That's afraidofnothingpodcast.com. And while you're there, click the coffee cup icon to buy me a coffee and leave a review. I'll give you a shout-out in an upcoming episode, and the world will know how swell you are.